Now we want to turn to a high school competition that is taking off this weekend. And no, we are not talking football or cheerleading. This is the finals of the nation's largest rocketry tournament. 100 teams will gather for the Team America Rocketry Challenge this weekend in Washington, D.C. And if you think making a little model rocket is easy, listen to this. Teams will have one chance to launch their rockets and make them fly as close to 800 feet as possible in about 45 seconds. And the rockets have to carry two raw eggs into the air and bring them back safely. Today we are checking in with members of the rocketry team from Wooddale High School in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, Wooddale is not in a particularly affluent area in Memphis, and at first, members of the team were not sure they could even afford to make the trip. But after a local newspaper profiled the team, supporters in the city stepped up to help them get to Washington. And Darius Hooker and Wesley Carter are the two seniors on the team, and they are joining us now. Congratulations. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate all the support we've gotten.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Well, why do I sound more excited than you two do? Is that that's the rocket? Is that the rocket man kind of? You got to be really very cool.
You have to be laid back.
It's been a lot of long mornings, long nights.
Okay. So you're tired. Well, I was reading that nobody in either of your families has a science or engineering background. So how did you get into building rockets?
This is Darius. Me and Wesley actually met at a summer program that Wooddale hosts. We kind of started building little small Estes rocket kits, and it kind of sparked from there. Our 10th grade year, we had someone approach us about the Team America Rocketry Challenge and ask us were we interested in it. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, it's just been 3 years of hard work and dedication towards making it to this competition. The third year was the charm, and we actually qualified to make it.
Right. Wesley, what's fun about it? What do you like about it?
I like the hard work and dedication about everything. Also, the teamwork we have, like when we go out those early mornings, once we shoot those rockets, it's either going to be a good thing or a bad thing. So what makes me really happy is just seeing the rocket go up and come back in peace and doing what we planned on it to do.
I'm imagining that being in the rocket club, particularly when you were younger guys, was probably like being in the glee club. Not the coolest. I don't know. So I just wanted to ask, did you ever have that experience? And how did you, you know, overcome the usual?
My ninth and 10th grade year, to be honest, yeah, we were kind of like the outcast of the whole thing. My 11th and 12th grade year, me and Wesley kind of turned that around 100%. We were like the guys on campus. We are what's happening. And, I mean, people see that we have things going for ourselves, so everybody wants a piece of what's going on. I didn't let anybody's words get me down. I always knew what I was waking up to go to school for at the end of the day.
Wesley, what about you?
We came in our ninth grade year, and we would sit in class, and you know everybody would be like, hey, Darius, or hey, Wesley, can you give us answers to this, this, this? And we would be completely nice about it, but once we get out of class, man, we had no friends at all. So me and Darius had to keep each other up. Once.
Well, I bet that changed, though, once your pictures were all in the newspapers, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
It completely changed. Once everybody started seeing us how we were getting such publicity and how really smart that we were, everyone were like, okay, these guys are really going to do it one day. We need to hang around them, not mess with them anymore. You know, that was the thing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with two members of Memphis's Wooddale High School rocket team, Darius Hooker and Wesley Carter. Their team is competing in the national finals of the Team America Rocketry Challenge this weekend in Washington, D.C. As I mentioned, when you first got entry into the competition, you weren't sure you were going to have the money to go. And then the donations just poured in. How did that feel?
Man, this is Darius. For the past 3 years, I know myself, I've been talking about just this story, and I kind of had this vision all in my mind of us making it. It's all blowing up in the newspapers, and now that it's here, I'm like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And just from that first commercial appeal ad, just within 24 hours, we were getting fan mail. We got a $3,000 check handed to us, and we had pictures of the guy handing it to us, and I was so overwhelmed with the support that we got from the community and everybody who reached out to us and had faith in us.
However it turns out, it's certainly a great journey to getting that point, but what's next for each of you? Wesley, do you want to go first?
Once I graduate, I plan on attending Middle Tennessee State University for air traffic control and dispatch. I've been an intern for 2 years at Memphis International Airport. once I leave Middle Tennessee, I have to go to the Air Traffic Control Academy in Oklahoma City. And I plan on being a manager either here in Memphis or Chicago doing air traffic control.
Oh, okay. Sounds like a plan. I see you haven't thought it through at all. Darius, what about you? What's next for you?
Yes, ma'am. We've both been working on our pilot license. When we came into Wooddale, that was kind of the thing. We wanted to be the pilots. But as we got into the field, we realized that being a pilot isn't everything. After high school, I'll be going to college over in Arkansas to get my A&P license for aircraft mechanic. After that, FedEx will be picking me up as an aircraft mechanic, and they will be paying for my degree at Embry-Riddle. And I will go from there.
What advice are you giving to the younger students now who want to get involved in rockets or science in general? Maybe, Darius, I'll start with you.
I was kind of scared coming into it. I mean, it's rocket science. This is actually something that you can't consider rocket science. So I was actually intimidated coming into it, but you could do anything you put your mind to. Don't ever let anybody tell you that you can't do it. To me, I feel like the sky isn't the limit. It goes beyond that. Once you lower your head and charge at it, go at it full force, and as good as yours.
Wesley, what about you?
I think every child should listen to their mother or father in a positive way, because it's going to help in the future. If you have a mind setting like you want to do something, even if you think about doing about 10 different things, man, that's fine as long as you're still thinking forward.
Wesley Carter and Darius Hooker are members of the Wooddale High School Rocket Team. They're based in Memphis, Tennessee. This weekend, they will compete in the finals of the Team America Rocketry Challenge in Washington, D.C., and they were with us from member station WKNO in Memphis. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. Good luck to you both.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
This bleak picture of the job market after graduation may affect how much families decide to pay for college, or in some cases, whether students even go. We've been examining difficult financial decisions like that in our ongoing series, Family Matters, and we continue the conversation today with financial advisor Tim Maurer. This seems like a pretty stunning number. I mean, just half of college graduates who graduated from 2009 to 2011 are finding work within a year. What do you make of this?
Sadly, it doesn't surprise me. It's what I'm hearing from families. It's also what I'm hearing from students. I teach 40 accounting students every semester, and when I ask them, what is the reason that you decided to become an accounting major over a marketing major, over a philosophy major, the answer that they invariably give me semester after semester, the reason is job security.
Their thinking is, I'm going to go into accounting because that offers me the best chance for a stable job, you know, in what is a really tough market.
Exactly. It's hard. Not so many people want to do it. They realize that they have the capacity to do it. They may not even love it. In fact, many of them tell me they don't, but they know they're going to have a job afterwards. So they're actually establishing the whole foundation for their lives in the future based on job security today, based on this kind of statistic.
Well, I suppose, and these new numbers, I mean, some people are going to look at them and more people are really going to begin to wonder if college is worth it and think about other options.
Well, there's another factor at play there, and that is the cost of college. There's no question it's been going up between 5% and 7% per year for over about 10, 15 years now. It's something that is almost out of reach of so many people these days that there are many saying these statistics, the employment statistics and the cost of school, are going to begin to drive those costs down, which is something that no one would have anticipated 10 years ago.
Suppose I'm a 16 or a 17-year-old, and I read the story about, you know, these new numbers, and I come to you and I say, how do I make this decision, Tim? How do I decide if going to college is a good idea, or how do I decide, you know, maybe it's just not right for me, maybe I should think about something else?
Here's what I recommend for students. Take a look at the value proposition. It's true that education is in many ways priceless, but it is not without a price tag. And for that reason, when I'm talking to a student who might be passionately interested in social work, I'm going to recommend that they not consider necessarily going to NYU and racking up a ton of bills that they will not be able to pay back. You need to gauge how much you're willing to pay for your education based on how much money that's going to help you make in the future.
Tim, just so I'm clear, you know, this new study that we're talking about, you know, so few students graduating from college from 2009, 2011 actually getting jobs. Could this just be a bad economy, or are you seeing some larger changes that are happening?
I think it's largely driven by the bad economy. When I was graduating from college in 1998, it was towards the end of the big tech bubble, and I was in the finance world. They were hiring hand over fist. I had a full-time job in my last semester of school. So things have certainly changed to a great degree. As I said, now even accounting students are having difficulty getting jobs. The economy absolutely plays a role, but the lesson is one that's actually valuable to the educators and the educated.
There seem to be, though, times when someone getting ready for college just can't put sort of a dollar figure on the value. I mean, they might feel a true connection to an institution. They like its reputation. They like the atmosphere. I mean, isn't that part of the value sometimes?
There's no question that the experience is part of it. And I'm not denying that either. When people refer to the most important part about college being the experience itself, I'm totally cool with that. The problem is we put a price on the other experiences that we undertake in life, do we not? When we go on vacation, we put a price on that. So I do agree with the experience argument, but I think it's important then to say, what is that experience worth? It's not priceless.
Tim, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
Happy to be here.
That's Tim Maurer. He's a financial advisor and also an adjunct professor of financial planning at Towson University. When it comes to monsters on television, vampires seem to have the market cornered. I mean, think about it. True Blood, Vampire Diaries, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. TV vampires are so popular, this weekend comes a new movie inspired by one. Dark Shadows aired on ABC in the late 1960s and early 70s. Now it's gone to the big screen. NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look at a TV genre that will never die.
Mark DeWidziak says his fascination with vampires began watching TV when he was 7 years old. He was watching Bela Lugosi play Dracula in an old Abbott and Costello movie.
What we need today is young blood and brains.
It was almost like a hand grabbing me by the throat, and it wouldn't let me go.
Vampires still have a hold on DeWidziak. He's written books about them and even teaches a class about vampires on film and television at Kent State University.
The great innovations as far as vampire characters go always have come from either the printed page or television. Television has contributed as much, if not more, than movies ever have.
So let's do a little TV vampire hunting through the decades. They've been in comedies like The Munsters.
Herman, please. I asked you never to pound steaks when I'm around. You know it gives me heartburn.
On Sesame Street.
Four. Five.
And in sexy nighttime dramas like True Blood.
I'm not a total fool.
Oh, but you have other very juicy arteries.
It's a fascination with the idea of living forever.
Seth Graham Smith wrote the screenplay to the new Dark Shadows movie and to another movie opening this summer based on his novel Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
We all know that someday our lives are going to end and we're going to miss whatever comes after that. Vampires, they don't have that problem. Now, depending on, you know, what interpretation of vampires you're talking about, they also can't go to the beach and enjoy a sunny day, but, you know, it seems a fair trade for eternal life.
And with eternal life comes almost unlimited powers and ratings. Crashing waves on a rocky coastline marked the beginning of another episode of Dark Shadows. From 1966 to 1971, it aired live every weekday afternoon on ABC.
My name is Victoria Winters.
Pretty young Victoria Winters is the governess for the wealthy Collins family in their creepy old mansion on the Maine coast. At first, the supernatural elements on the show were mostly suggested, not seen.
And the show was going down the tubes. And my
That's the late Dan Curtis, who created the series. In a special edition DVD, Curtis said that ABC was ready to cancel Dark Shadows. He says his kids told him, at least make it scary. So with special effects, he introduced a ghost you could see.
From that moment, the ratings started to climb.
So he added more ghosts.
And they get higher and higher the crazier we got.
So Curtis said, let's add a vampire.
If his ghost is here with yours, tell him I've come home. I claim this house as mine.
Wearing a cape and stiff as a board, Barnabas Collins was played by the late Jonathan Frid, who was not really a pretty boy like today's TV vampires.
But housewives, college girls, everybody just fell in love with him.
Catherine Lee Scott played Maggie Evans in the original TV show.
I wish those dogs would stop howling. They're beginning to make me nervous.
Well, I've kept you long enough, Miss...
Oh, Evans. Maggie Evans.
Evans.
It was amazing because you can't imagine the mail that he got. Some of it pretty erotic.
Jonathan Frid's Barnabas Collins was so popular, they couldn't drive a stake through his heart at the end of his 90-day contract, as originally planned. Instead, he became the star of Dark Shadows. Mark Dawidziak.
The genius of the Barnabas Collins character was that Barnabas is the first vampire who questions his own nature. Barnabas said, do I have to be like this?
What have I become? How can I do things I do? Shall eternity be like this?
By giving Barnabas Collins a conscience and relationships, Dark Shadows opened up all kinds of possibilities, says Dawidziak.
And this is where the vampire is going to become increasingly humanized, sexualized, sensualized. They're going to become younger. They're going to become more vital.
More than four decades later, just about every vampire on TV still owes a debt to Dark Shadows, right down to the Vampire Diaries on the CW.
Why do you always have to prove you're the alpha male?
I don't have to prove anything, love. I am the alpha male. Come on. One dance. I won't bite.
The Vampire Diaries is a gothic soap opera, similar to Dark Shadows, but with two big differences. Much better production values, and the vampires are mostly teenagers. The show's co-creator, Julie Pleck, says the coming-of-age idea is something they got from another TV show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, created by Joss Whedon.
Joss Whedon sort of gets the super gold star for the high school is hell allegory, and that was the beauty of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Look, this can't
ever be anything. Enough. For one thing, you're like 224 years older than I am.
I gotta walk away from this.
I know.
This idea that, you know, the worst thing that happens is you finally give up your virginity to your one true love, and the next day he turns into an evil murderous side of vampire.
Right, but all of these contemporary vampires would not exist without Jonathan Frid's Barnabas Collins, says actress Catherine Lee Scott.
I think they all emanate from him. He's the granddaddy of all of them.
Jonathan Frid died in April, but he and Catherine Lee Scott and other actors from the Dark Shadows TV show have cameos in the new movie. Johnny Depp, who was a fan of the original, plays Barnabas Collins. And like the original, his Barnabas apologizes before sucking people's blood. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This spring, about 1.5 million people across the United States are graduating from a four-year college. Most will be looking for a job.
And they have reason to expect one. Experts have said countless times, including on this program, that a college education tremendously improves your odds in the job market. But if the experiences of recent graduates are any guide, many will be disappointed.
A new survey out today tracks college grads since 2006. Just half of them are working full-time. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The recession started in Caitlin LaCour's freshman year at Columbia College Chicago. By graduation last year,
I thought that I wasn't going to get a job, like many people. But I was happy to, you know, have one part-time job.
And LaCour feels lucky that it's related to her major in radio production. She does promotions at a radio station. But she earns just $10 an hour. And by the time she had to start payments on her $100,000 in student loans, she realized it would not be nearly enough. LaCour took on a second part-time job at a shoe store, then a third also at the radio station.
Like, I got addicted to working, pretty much, to where I kind of just, like, burned myself out because I didn't want to have to worry about not being able to pay my loan.
Those student loans are more than $700 a month, and the only way she can pay them, living rent-free with her parents, a situation that's come to symbolize graduating post-recession.
More come out with debt than come out with jobs.
Cliff Zukin is with the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. His new study finds 6 in 10 students take on debt, more than $20,000 on average, even as a lack of jobs leaves them less able to pay it back.
In the data, there's certainly a suggestion that the American dream has stopped at these guys' doorstep.
Zukin says nearly half those with full-time work are in jobs that don't actually require a college degree. And as for a career, very few say their first job would lead to that. In fact, a third of recent college grads say they no longer believe education plus hard work will necessarily lead to success.
They don't even see in the foreseeable future a secure job, a comfortable income, starting a family, and even more, 45% do not see owning a home at any point in the near future.
And Zukin notes these are the cream of the crop. Unemployment is far higher among the majority of young Americans who don't go to college. The Rutgers study finds a fifth of recent grads have gone back to school, where many are accumulating more debt. Meantime, those getting jobs since the recession have seen a hit on their paychecks.
About 10% lower earnings, and that earnings effect fades in about 10 years.
Although it varies, says Columbia University economist Till von Vactor. If you're, say, an engineering grad from a top school, his research shows you can job hop and get back to what you would have been earning in 3 or 4 years. But
students who come from smaller, less well-known schools and have majors such as humanities or arts, they tend to have depressed career paths lasting for a very long time.
And in fact, many grads in the Rutgers survey say they wished they'd majored in something else. Researcher Cliff Zukin wonders if it's the end of the happy, self-confident millennials as we've come to know them. Then again, it can be more depressing to read the study's numbers than to speak with some recent grads.
I love the people I work with. I love my customers. I'm a people person.
Tiffany Connor's working 2 part-time retail jobs in Wisconsin by choice. After graduating in 2009, she actually landed a full-time job in her field of marketing. But it didn't make her happy, so she quit and moved back in with her parents to figure out something new. Connor's focus now is paying down student loan and credit card debt.
You know, debt is just one of those pieces of life, and being miserable about it isn't good either. So keep my head up high, I guess, keep plugging away, and I have nothing to be ashamed of.
After all, she knows she has plenty of company. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Finally today, I was thinking about a conversation I had with a friend of mine who just got back from a wedding in Central America. He was telling me how impressed he was that just about everybody at his hotel was, it seemed to him, effortlessly bilingual, even multilingual. People switched back and forth from Spanish to English and sometimes to French in the span of minutes, depending on who was standing there and what was needed. I thought, of course they are. They have to be. Their livelihood and advancement depend upon it. It's the same thing another friend of mine told me when I was doing some reporting in Canada, and I was similarly impressed with the language skills of the people I ran into there. That friend of mine, a Canadian, laughed at me. Of course they are. They have to be bilingual, he said, to make a living and most especially to get ahead. So that's what came to mind when I started hearing yet again about why diversity doesn't matter, or at least why it shouldn't matter, or at least why liberals, and I'm putting that in air quotes, need to do a better job of defending it. Now, this is one of those hardy perennials that tends to come up when there are primary elections where someone feels the need to draw some ethnic hard line or racial stress points of one sort or another emerge. Interestingly enough, recently some conservative writers have rediscovered a 2006 study published in 2007 that we talked about on this program. That study was by Robert Putnam, the social scientist famous for his previous work on civic engagement called Bowling Alone. The work I'm talking about was a massive study of how diversity affects civic engagement, and he found, to his discomfort actually, that more diverse communities actually suffer in many ways from civic withdrawal, that people are less likely to volunteer, vote, give to charity, and work on projects together. People trust each other less, so they do less and hunker down. Can I just tell you, is this really a surprise? Diversity is hard for the same reason marriage is hard. You're asking people who were raised in different houses, different families, usually different genders, to submerge a part of themselves for the sake of the whole. You're asking people to think of someone else's feelings, if not instead of their own, at least alongside their own. And when was that ever easy, even when you're in love? But we don't tell people to stop getting married. And more to the point, today, this country, and in fact the world, is not going to get less diverse. And do we really want to encourage more tribalism, since our recent adventures in that worked out so well with catastrophes like World War II, the Balkan Wars, and the Rwandan genocide? So why don't we stop whining about what is and get busy with what could be? Just focusing on this country again, it seems to me the issue is not whether diversity is a civic strength or liability. That's interesting and instructive, but rather beside the point at this stage. But rather, how should it be talked about, even taught? To me, the right analogy is a life skill, kind of like swimming. Not impossible when you're older, but easier when you are young. Not always necessary, but life-saving when it is. It seems to me that people who don't want to face this are the kind of people who live near the beach but never get in the water, which, come to think of it, is why I'm not surprised they are often so grumpy. Recently, a white National Review writer was fired for a commentary that his editors deemed racist and gratuitously inflammatory. I won't quarrel with their decision. The writer trafficked in some very tired stereotypes about race and intellect, among other things. But he did say one thing I found intriguing. He said he was encouraging his children to make a black friend at work. Now, it was a cynical suggestion meant for political cover, not friendship. But it still wasn't a bad one. When an ability to function in diverse environments becomes necessary for our livelihoods and advancement, believe me, we will jump in that water, whether it is cold or not. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.